pick up in Matthew chapter 5, brothers and sisters. From verse 33, having considered in the last couple of classes the principle of the marriage vow, and that from a scriptural point of view and the teaching of the Lord, how essential it is to keep that vow until death does the parting of the one or other of the husband or wife. We now have in verse 33 the principle of vows. And that seems very appropriate in the context, because marriage, after all, is a vow, is an oath, where two people join together for life. And therefore the Lord now seems to extend that thought from verse 33 and deepens the need almost for faithfulness and truthfulness. The words, I think, are familiar. Verse 33, again you have heard that it has been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shall perform unto the Lord thine oaths. Now, notice in your margin, if you've got the Oxford version, that the quotation, they say, is perhaps from Leviticus chapter 19. We're going to have a look at that in a moment. And I think the reason for the uncertainty on the part of the translators is that perhaps more than some of the other quotations which the Lord makes as to what the Jewish tradition was, this had been sort of amplified and twisted perhaps more than others. The Authorized Version is not necessarily particularly clear. The Jerusalem Bible gives verse 33 this way. You have heard that it has been said by them of old time, you must not break your oath, but must fulfill your oaths to the Lord. Thou shalt not forswear thyself, they put, you must not break your oath. And basically, a vow was generally confirmed by an oath. They swore that they were going to keep what they had promised. And that was the principle behind what the Lord has said. To confirm what they had promised, a vow, by means of an oath. By saying, I swear that I will do this and that. Now, if we go back to Leviticus chapter 19, you'll see the context in which this particular tradition had become sort of built up. Leviticus 19 and verse 12, you shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. And that's the implication of verse 12, that if you made a vow and you wanted to confirm your willingness to keep that vow, and you wanted to confirm it with an oath, then you had to make sure you kept it. You cannot swear by my name falsely. Now, there was no obligation for any Israelite to make a vow. But what he had to do, because of what verse 12 says, when he made it, it had to be kept. Now, again, if we go forward to Deuteronomy chapter 10... there's another interesting implication which the Jews built upon this idea of confirming their vows with these oaths. Deuteronomy chapter 10, and in verse 20, thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, him shalt thou serve, and to him shalt thou cleave, and swear by his name. And they made out from this verse that the only way, truthfully, you could confirm a vow with an oath was to do it unto God. So basically, if we can put it in the common language, they felt that by swearing unto God, or swearing on his name, that would confirm the truthfulness of the vow which they had promised. And therefore, nothing which wasn't confirmed by an oath wasn't necessarily valid. Now, the law didn't allow that. The law said any vow that you made had to be kept. But the Jews had taken this principle one stage further and said for any vow to be kept, it had to be ratified by this oath. And that oath had to be in the name of God, which meant that it had to be kept. Now, if we go back to Exodus chapter 20, they then brought the principle of one of the Ten Commandments into their thinking. And that's the third commandment in verse 7 of Exodus chapter 20. When it says, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain." And again, in basic English, what the third commandment was saying, you had to keep what you had promised. You had to keep your word. Don't say you're serving God if you're not. Don't say that you're not going to kill if you kill. Don't say you're not going to steal if you steal. You have to keep that which you have promised. And if you don't, it's tantamount to taking the name of God in vain. Now, in order to circumvent that, the Jews built up a tradition by refusing to mention the name of God. And every time the word Yahweh appeared or was to be read, they changed it and used the word Adonai, meaning, as we know, Lord or ruler. So they felt they were safe then because they were not taking the name of God in vain. They had overcome the problem of the third commandment. So when they made a vow, because they weren't swearing by the name of God, they're only swearing by one of his titles, it meant that they didn't really have to keep the vow either. So if anybody challenged them, they can say, "Well, we haven't broken the law. We said the vow in all good intention, but we haven't confirmed it with an oath to the name of our God. And the reason we haven't done that is because it is against our beliefs to mention the name of God, and therefore we can't use his name to confirm it by an oath." And so they built up this sort of tradition amongst themselves about the fulfilling of vows. Now, if we take that thought back to Matthew chapter 5, the Lord was in essence using what had become the tradition. "Thou hast heard it been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself." And they would say, "We don't, because we do not swear by the name of God." And therefore, because of that, what thou shalt perform unto the Lord, in the end of verse 33, was not necessarily valid because they hadn't sworn unto the Lord that they would perform the oath. They'd made the vow on behalf of whatever they were willing to promise. If they fulfilled it, fine, but if they didn't, they didn't feel under any obligation. Now, obviously, it was a whole mockery of the law and of the things which God had written. And therefore, the Lord Jesus Christ, in verses 34, 35 and 36, wanted to emphasize to the disciples, and obviously to all disciples of all ages, not to get involved in any of these traditions, and basically, in verse 34, not to swear at all. Now, when we consider that it was a reasonable, almost a natural inclination to want to emphasize or to prove to somebody
that what you have promised you will perform. And therefore, if you wanted to give the authority the proof that your word was your bond, if you say that God is my witness that I will do thus and so, then that would add weight, or apparently add weight, to what you had said. The Lord says, I don't want you to swear at all. Because what I want you to appreciate in verse 37, that your yea is yea, and your nay is nay. To a disciple, his word is truth. You don't have to emphasize it. You don't have to prove the point. Everyone should come to acknowledge and understand that what you promise, you will perform. They don't need additional proof. They don't need additional emphasis upon the matter. Now, of course, in common law today, we obviously, if we're going to make any sort of promise from a legal point of view, it has to be binding. And sometimes if you make a statement, they want it confirmed, you know, under oath, that you're telling the truth. Now, that is a legal requirement, because under this country, obviously, not many people do tell the truth. And therefore, because you're then obligated to perform what you have said, they make you confirm it with an oath. Now, if you go into court, you know, you swear, under normal circumstances, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And if you don't tell the truth, then you can be out of the perjury. You're in contempt of court. If it can be proven that what testimony and evidence you've given is not true. And the reason that was brought in, because the majority of people were lying, as the term is, through the back teeth. The fact that they'd said something, you know, was immaterial to that, and we hear it every day of the week. You can't sort of, you know, the classic one, I suppose, is the checks in the post syndrome. You know, where everybody makes up lies to try and impress people with the fact that they are doing something about a particular bill or whatever the case may be. Now, what the Master wants us to appreciate is that our word should be true on each and every occasion, irrespective of what we have promised and what we say. So whether we are promising it unto the Lord, promising it unto our brethren and sisters, or promising it unto the Gentiles at large, it's the same truth. We don't say one thing unto God, knowing he's going to check up on us because he knows our thoughts and our deeds, and yet still be able to sort of not be able to tell the truth to others. The Master wants us to appreciate that we don't have to emphasize, we don't have to confirm, as it were, with an oath, that the vow that we have promised, or whatever we have said, we will perform. Now, to emphasize this more, he uses these three illusions in verses 34, 35, and 36. Because the children of Israel, or the people of Israel, wouldn't use the name of God in the swearing of an oath, then they used to swear by heaven. And they used to say, you know, on the fact that, as you know, heaven is God's throne or God's dwelling place, then I will perform that which I have promised. And I suppose today we still hear the phrase good heavens. And it was really on the basis of this where it came from. Because all good heavens really mean, and please excuse me, I don't want to be blasphemous anyway, is a derivation from good God. And because people felt that using the name of God in vain was wrong, they changed good God to good heavens. It's the same blasphemous effect. And what the Master is saying is that everything, what we can think about, is under the auspices of God. If we think of heaven, it's his throne.
If we think of earth, it's his footstool. If we think of Jerusalem, it's a city of the great king. Now, if we go back to Isaiah 66, it's appropriate when we think of the heaven and the earth and Jerusalem as his city, that in Isaiah 66 and verse 1, thus saith Yahweh, the heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that ye build unto me? Where is the place of my rest? For all these things have mine hand made, and all those these things have been, saith the Lord. But to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word. And he's emphasizing here that the earth is his footstool, the heaven is his throne. But to the man that I will look to is the one who is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at his word. And therefore everything what we can possibly think of is either been created by God or is under the control of God. And therefore, whatever vow we are promising to whoever comes under the auspices that God requires a disciple to tell the truth at all times. And so coming back to verse 36. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. You were created. Men did not create themselves, they don't own themselves. And therefore, how can they confirm anything on the basis of themselves? It's all of God. Because we cannot change one iota of the way we are as far as our physical appearance is concerned. You cannot make one hair white or black. Obviously, these in the age before dyes and all the magic potions of today. But I'm sure we get the principle. That, you know, everything is of God. And therefore the Master's advice is, let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. We shouldn't need to emphasize, we shouldn't have to colour our comments. Our word is our bond. And sometimes we're guilty, and perhaps all of us at times are guilty of wanting to almost prove what we've said is going to be true. As sure as night follows day, I'm going to do thus and so, or you know, many other the phrases which can be done. And the Master's advice is, don't. Let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. Don't colour it, don't emphasise it. Just tell the truth at all times, and then no one will question at all ever that what you have said you will perform. Because if we turn it round, once we have said something which we don't keep, then of course we are caught out. People then can't trust us. People then are suspicious of us. And that's why in verse 37, the Master is careful to emphasize that if we are not willing to do that, then obviously anything of more than this cometh of evil. And therefore he wants us to be precise, genuine and honest in our communication before men. Don't do it for effect. That's basically what I feel his advice is. Don't take the name of God in vain. We have promised to be true to him, and therefore in every aspect therefore we have to be true to everyone else, because everything is under the authority of God. And I believe it all is stemming from verses 31 and 32 that in marriage we likewise keep our vows. We tell the truth. We promise what we have performed. And therefore he enlarges that and deepens that and says, look, in every aspect of life, whatever it is, whether it's at home, whether it's in business, in the ecclesia, whatever, tell the truth. Let people come to respect that your yea is yea and your nay is nay. He then goes on in verse 38 by saying, you have heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. For I say unto you that you resist not evil. Now again, I believe we've got a continuation of a thought and of a theme. All the way through, from the Beatitudes, when the Lord has been amplifying and enlarging what's required of a disciple, he's wanting to see the truth in action, the way it affects us, the way it is shown in our life. Now, we're all different characters, we're all different people. Now, it may well be that verses 33 to 37 don't present a problem. Maybe we're a person of few words. I have the problem in verse 37 because I always think, you know, why use one word if 10 will do? Others obviously look at it the other way, why use 10 when one will do? And therefore the spirit of verse 37 will come easier to some than to others. And therefore people who are, shall we say, very conservative in their speech may be able to precisely not colour anything they say. Others who are more verbal then obviously have the problem which has to be controlled. But contrary-wise, in verse 38, depending upon your character, some people, if they're born naturally cowards, would not want to return a blow for a blow or a smite for a smite. But for those who are, of course, more aggressive and therefore more in danger, it becomes more of a problem. And I think the Lord is challenging every aspect of the differences in our characters. Just because we might, if I can use the word, excel in one, we may fall short, very much so, in another. And what he wants us to do is try and bring ourselves up at all times to the standard and the level we expect of all his disciples in every aspect of life. And therefore again, in verse 38, he's basically saying, which we know under the law, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. The law of Moses, like the law of today, allows justice to be done. And therefore, if someone has wronged you, then you have the right to demand justice. Now, we won't go from every one of the quotations, but let's just go back to Exodus chapter 21. Because there are many references under the law where this eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is taken from. But in verse 22 of Exodus 21, if men strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished, according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And if any mischief follow, then shalt thou give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Now I personally don't believe that this is to be taken literally. I don't believe that the law was saying, well, if somebody, you know, causes an injury to occur and you lose your sight of an eye, then you can likewise poke somebody else back in the eye so he loses his eye. Now, is there any sense in that at all? And I don't think it means, literally, an eye for an eye. What I do believe it means is equal. That there was a just and fair compensation. Because you've lost the use of an eye, or a tooth, or a hand, or a foot, or whatever the case may be. So that you could, under the law, demand justice, recompense, compensation for that which you have lost. Now again, I think the law of the land today is likewise trying to support that principle. That if you have been injured by another party, You can go to law, and I'm speaking obviously from a natural point of view, and demand compensation, demand retribution, demand justice to be done. And these days it's gone taken to the nth degree that if somebody even slanders you, you can demand, you know, incredible compensations. I believe the law of Moses, more than this country, demanded justice to be done. I don't think it was to overcompensate nor undercompensate. I think it was going to be a fair and just recompense. But it did allow the man to appeal to the law for this justice to be performed. And when we come back to Matthew chapter 5, I believe in essence what the Lord is saying in verse 39, that I say unto you that you resist not evil. And then in the rest of verse 39, then in 40, then in 41, and then in 42, he presents four examples of what he means. But why, first of all, did he say that for the disciple he should not demand justice? I believe there's two answers to that. First of all, when we consider where was the justice in a righteous man having to die for sinners? Where was the justice in what God, through the Lord Jesus Christ, has done for us, as compared to what we do for him? Where's the justice? Where's the fair compensation that a righteous man would lay down his life for others? And secondly, I believe the Lord is wanting us to demonstrate that if we demand justice on an equal basis, we're fighting like with like. We're showing the same character as the person to whom the justice is demanded. In other words, we're not trying to elevate our character above anyone else. I think there's some lovely examples in Scripture in this regard, but let's just take a couple of advices from the apostles. First of all, can we go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5? Take up his thoughts in verse 14 of 1 Thessalonians 5. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn them that are unruly, comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, be patient to all men, see that none render evil for evil unto any, but ever follow that which is good, both among yourselves and to all. Now I believe there is a great depth of understanding and appreciation of what the apostle is saying. He's saying, don't be like the others. Show that the truth has affected you deeply so that you are not demanding recompense. You're not demanding compensation. If they want to injure you, then accept it. Because when the Lord, obviously, was being taken unjustly, and he was being tried unjustly, and he was being punished unjustly, and he was being crucified unjustly, where was his resistance? He was rising above their level. He wasn't demanding his rights, as it were, for justice to be carried out. He let himself to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. And that's the spirit of the Beatitude. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my name's sake. It's one thing accepting, appreciating that. It's another thing living it. And what the Master is wanting us to appreciate is that when something is done against you, are you allowed to bear it, or do you want immediately to retaliate? So we go to 1 Peter chapter 3. And verse 18. Servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward. For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffer wrongfully. For what glory is it if, when you be buffeted for your faults, you shall take it patiently? But if when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. Now what he's saying, obviously, in essence, if we take the first of the examples the Lord brings before us, if somebody, because you've upset them, wants to smite you on the cheek, sorry, 1 Peter 2 I should have said, I'll say 3. Sorry, it's 1 Peter 2. They shouldn't put the thing on the top of the page, should they? Yeah. It's 1 Peter 2. I'll read it again so we've got it. Verse 19. For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffer wrongfully. For what glory is if when you be buffeted for your faults you shall take it patiently, but if when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. So I was saying, if we go back to Matthew chapter 5 and take the first of the illustrations, if you've upset somebody and he wants to smite you on the cheek, the Master says, you don't resist it. Peter takes the thought and says you don't resist it, even if he's doing it without a cause. Because if he wants to wrongfully abuse you in that way, then you have to accept it. And the Master is saying, turn to him the other cheek also. He's doing it without a cause. Because if he wants to wrongfully abuse you in that way, then you have to accept it. And the Master is saying, turn to him the other cheek also. Now, I don't care who we are, that's difficult. It is difficult to rise above the natural reaction, which I think is inbuilt in most people. But what the Master is wanting to demonstrate is that the truth should have affected us, not to respond from a natural point of view. And I think the whole essence of the teaching of the Master here on the Sermon on the Mount is that we are rising above our natural inclinations and desires and thoughts and attitudes to bring them onto a spiritual plane so that we are, if I can use the term, and don't misunderstand me, we are responding or fighting back, not with natural values, but with spiritual ones. And there's nothing more infuriating or nothing more unanswerable to someone who wants to pick a fight is when you won't. When you are, shall we say, trying to pacify and trying to reason with them. Now we can take this, I know, to the absolute extreme. When people want to beat you up for the sake of beating you up, you've got to ask yourself the question first and foremost, why have you ever got yourself into that situation? There's not many people who will, unprovoked, want to hit you. I mean, probably none of us can remember the last time we were, hit in any unprovoked or even a provoked way. Generally, it's the last resort where you have caused something to happen. Now, I accept that, you know, you could be unfortunate. That, you know, 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night, walking down the street, fight outside the pub and somebody just picks on you. You've got to ask yourself a question. Why are you walking the streets at 11:30 at night outside a pub? You know, you want to avoid the circumstances where indeed trouble could arise. And I believe the Master is saying, if you ever do get into the predicament, why have you got there in the first place? And you've got to rise above and almost fight back to him on a basis which basically he cannot understand and yet generally will have respect for. Because nobody really likes to beat up a defenceless person. And if you are saying that he can keep an itching you all night, you know, what motivates you is following the Lord Jesus, and therefore you will not respond and you will not hit back. They generally have all the wind taken out of their sails in the first place. And I think that was the frustration, what the Roman soldiers and the authorities found with the Lord. They didn't know how to handle him. And that's why Pilate, I'm sure, said, I can't find any fault in this man. Normally, if somebody was going to be beaten up and he was going to be scourged and spat upon, the natural thing would be to swear back, blaspheme, curse and all the rest of it. And the world responds to that sort of attitude. It can't seem to cope with the non-resistance. It can't seem to cope with the fact that you are not prepared to do anything but to try and get them to reason, understand why you are responding the way you are. Now, if you go to Lamentations of Jeremiah in chapter 3, Lamentations of Jeremiah chapter 3, let's take it up from verse 26. It is good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of Yahweh. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke of his youth. He sitteth alone and keepeth silence because he hath borne it upon him. He putteth his mouth in the dust, if so be there may be hope. He giveth his cheek to him that smiteth him. He is filled full with reproach, for the Lord will not cast off for ever. But though he cause grief, yet he will have compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. And that seems to be the spirit which the Lord is expecting of his disciples. Everything is known of God. And as the Lord was willing to give his back to the smiters, as he was willing to submit himself to the abuse and everything which man was prepared to put upon him, he was trying to point out the wrongness of their doing. He was trying to elevate them to a better understanding and appreciation. And I think that's what he did. If you look at John chapter 18, John chapter 18, look at verse 22. When he had spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, Answerest thou the high priest so? And Jesus answered and said, If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil, but if well, why smitest thou me? And he was trying to reason with them as to why they were doing something. The wrongness of their actions was apparent for all to see. And I believe if we went down John chapter 18 and that, it was for this very reason, and we could go all the way down, that we come to verse 38, that Pilate had to say, I find no fault at all in him. Now, if we accept that he wouldn't have been Roman governor if there wasn't a bit of intelligence in Pilate, he could see that what was being done to Jesus was totally wrong. And I believe that if Jesus had reacted from a natural point of view, we wouldn't have had that reaction from Pilate. It was just because of the attitude and the way the master conducted himself that this person could understand and appreciate there couldn't be anything wrong with him. What he was doing, what he was saying, the way he was conducting himself was according to his belief. And I think we've got that likewise of the Apostle Paul. Now when we come back to Matthew chapter 5, it's one thing to react or not react to insult, as verse 39 indicates. But what about the next bit? What about if somebody wants to take legal action against you? Verse 40. If any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. First of all, I think the master would be asking the question in this, why should he want to sue you? Why should he want to take you to law? If the law allowed, verse 38, justice to be done, and allowed compensation and allowed retribution, what had you done? What problem had you got into which would allow him to go to law and to demand this compensation, this restitution? Now, I believe the coat and the cloak is sort of a phrase where if he's suing you and he's demanding your coat in return, then let him have your outer garment, your overcoat, as we would say. Now, there is a principle of this from the law. Can we go back to Exodus 22? Look at verse 26. If thou at all take thy neighbour's raiment to pledge, thou shalt deliver it unto him by that the sun goeth down. For that is his covering only, it is his raiment for his skin, wherein he shall he sleep, and it shall come to pass when he crieth unto me that I will hear, for I am gracious. So under the law, albeit justice was allowed to be done, that if somebody had taken your coat, then he had to recompense with his coat. But the law made sure that at the end of the day, he got it back so that he could sleep, that he had a covering for himself for the night. That's what the law said. Now, if we bring that back to Matthew chapter 5, if somebody is suing you, and let's say it's unjustly, let's say you've done nothing wrong, you know, you've got to check your own conscience and your own thoughts about that, whatever he demands, give him double. Give him more than is expected. And I believe again, the principle is that you are trusting in God to provide for you, and you're trying to establish yourself again on good relations with the person. And again, I think the essence of this will come out more and more through Matthew 5, 6 and 7. He wants us to make sure that we're not at odds with anybody. And if they have got something against us, and we can't avoid it, and we've done nothing to deserve it, or whatever, still, nevertheless, do more than is expected of you. And that again causes them to be either overwhelmed or wondering why. If they expect you to pay them, let's say £10, you give them £20. They can't understand the reasoning behind that. And therefore you explain why. Because you're motivated by these things, that's what the truth means, that's what the Lord expects of us. And therefore they come to appreciate that genuinely you're a decent guy, you've made a mistake, something's gone wrong, it's out of character with you, you didn't want it to happen, and therefore he's trouble. You're giving him twice as much than he expected. If we go to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. In verse 6 of 1 Corinthians 6, it's about brother going to law with brother, and that before unbelievers. But it's a lesson from verse 7 I want us to think about. Now therefore there is utterly a fault among you, because you go to law one with another. Why do you not rather take wrong? Why do you not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? And Paul's advice is the same as the master. Allow it to happen, and then, almost as it were, go overboard in your generosity and your willingness to put the matter right. That even if it's unjust, if it's unfair, try and show him that you're motivated by far better principles and you want to get back on good terms, you want to establish good relationship. And the whole essence of his teaching seems to be that. Do wrong to no one. Let them speak no evil or think no evil of you, and if through circumstances, justly or unjustly, you find yourself in this situation, then make sure that you are doing more than is expected of you. And that, I believe, is what we've got in verse 41 as well. Matthew chapter 5. Whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him two. Now, I've used it, and no doubt you've used it, and had it used in many contexts, verse 41. That if somebody asks you to give them a lift and drop them off at the corner, you then drop them off at the corner, you take them straight to the home. You put yourself out. It doesn't matter what extent you have to go to, you're willing to do it. Because that's what the Lord meant when he says, if he asks you to do something for him, do, again, more than is expected of you. And it's the whole principle of it. But there's a bit more to it, I believe, than just that, although that's the essence of the Lord's teaching. Notice the word compel. The Jews were an occupied nation. And the Romans, at will, could compel a Jew to do almost anything. It could take over his house. It could take over its animals, its donkey, its transport, whatever. It could ask him to do, or compel him to do, you know, an errand for them, or whatever the case may be. And therefore, if you are compelled to do whatever, do it. Not grudgingly, but willingly. Submit yourselves to their demands, however unfair it might be, and do a lot more than even they expect of you. Now again, that was an incredible situation to come across. You can imagine somebody, if they're told by a Roman, I want you to go and take this from here to there. Yeah. It's like when the boss at work comes and says, will you do this? If I have to. Yeah. And it's the same sort of attitude. You're willing to submit yourself to do it, and you do it willingly. The Lord loves a cheerful giver, and that's not just in a monetary sense. It's in whatever way we are to conduct our lives before him. And therefore, however unfair it is, however unjust it might seem, then we should be willing to perform it. Look at Romans 13. Romans chapter 13. verse 1. Let every soul be subject unto the highest powers. There is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whoso therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil wilt thou then not be afraid of their power. Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. He is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore you must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Now I shouldn't think there's one of us not guilty of moaning about how much tax we have to pay. But again, that is an incident, and may be a very small incident, but nevertheless, it reflects an attitude, says Christ. It's saying to you, you have to pay tribute unto Caesar. And therefore, we've got to appreciate that these things are ordained of God. And therefore, in essence, if we're moaning about that, we're moaning against God, because he's ordained it. He's caused it to be. He's caused it to happen. It's the same if we're moaning about a political party because they're in government and they're imposing this, that and the other. We've got to appreciate they've been put in power by God for our good. And we should be seen to have praise of the same. Not that the Prime Minister is going to send us a letter saying thank you for your sort of willing acceptance of me. But the fact that we are acknowledging that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And Nebuchadnezzar, we've just been reading, had to go through tremendous things and changes in his life so that he can come to accept that. That God rules in the kingdoms of men. Now, in a very more simplified way, we have to accept that this world in which we live is ordained of God. It is controlled by God. Everything is for our sakes. Now, if we are praising God in one sense for the peace and quiet that he affords us to be able to hold our own meetings and for arranging the affairs of this land so that without let and hindrance we can do thus and so. How on the other hand, whether it be in conversation with those we work with or neighbours or friends, how can we be bemoaning about those things which God has ordained? If you look at Titus chapter 3, and the reason for emphasising these things, which we know, is because we fall into the trap. We don't rise above the normal level of conversation which the world, unfortunately, engages into. And therefore, in Titus chapter 3 and verse 1, there's many others like this, but we'll just make do with these. Put them in mind, Titus 3 verse 1, to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates, to be ready to every good work, to speak evil of no man, to be no brawlers, but gentle, showing meekness unto all men. And therefore the Master is saying, look, it's not just a question in what you are saying is the truth. It's not only the fact that you're not resisting against evil, you're not fighting back. But in your day-to-day conversations, you're willing to submit yourselves unto what the state and the affairs of this world have placed upon you. And therefore, you're doing it in the right spirit, because there's a reason and a motive behind it. Not only do it cause you to live peaceably with all men, and that's paramount important, like we've been trying to stress. The whole attitude of a disciple of Christ is that we are live peaceably with all men. But it's a good discipline, because it provides you with an ample opportunity to witness positively. For if we're moaning about anything and decrying this and saying, I don't know why we have to pay this, or, you know, I think this is unfair, how can we then, on the other hand, expect people to appreciate that we've got no interest in the affairs of this world, we're looking for a kingdom to come, when we're moaning constantly about the way, you know, we're being afflicted by this world? How can we expect them to want to come and serve the Lord who we serve if we are saying, well, what he's allowed really is not very fair at all. And it can be just a word here or a word there which can cause the mind of others to be put against the things that we believe. And therefore he's trying to all the time make sure that the things that we say we believe are carried forward into every avenue of our lives. Not just a question on a Sunday morning in the meeting to be able to say to one another, this is what we believe, here we are worshipping God. But in every aspect of our life, it shows through. Now, because of our characters, some of us have to work on certain things more than others. But it's affecting all of us in every respect, in many ways. I think there's a lovely illustration of this. Can we come to Mark chapter 15? These are one of these things where maybe you're going to accuse me of being wrong, and I will accept it. But I think certain things in scriptures, we are just given a bit of information, and with a bit of scriptural license, I think we can build up a picture of something which emphasizes beautifully a point. And I believe this is one of these things. I can't prove it absolutely, but I think there's enough given to suggest that it could well be a fact. Mark 15, verse 21. Jesus, being taken to Golgotha to be crucified, bearing his cross. And in verse 21, the Romans, because he was bowing under the weight, compel one, Simon, a Cyrenian, who passed by, coming out of the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. It's the same word compel as we've got in Matthew chapter 5. If somebody to compel you to go a mile, go with him twain. And the Romans compelled this Simon, a Cyrenian, to bear the cross. He obviously shared the journey with the Lord. It could well be that he was there because at some point he'd been hearing the Lord speaking. I would suggest that he was not one of the followers because they'd all forsook him and fled. And therefore on this eventful journey, the Lord was on his own. But there would be those amongst the multitude who had obviously come to see whether or not what this man had been saying was true. If he was the Christ, if he was the Messiah, then he wouldn't allow himself to die. And I think there were many on the foot of the cross who were waiting for something miraculous to happen. And I think that was the spirit of the crowd. If he be the Christ, come down from the cross and we will believe. And I think a lot of people were wondering whether or not what he was saying, you know, made a lot of sense, but was it really true? And I am to believe that Simon, perhaps, was one of these, undecided. But he had the opportunity to be with the Lord and see the Lord suffer, and see the Lord accept willingly all the things which he had to go through. No reaction, no moans, no groans. And the Spirit of the Lord, I believe, was with Simon. And so rather than moaningly saying, oh, why have I got to bear this cross, you know, I think Simon was impressed with the Lord's attitude and would have gone forward. And I think the reaction afterwards would have caused Simon to come to the truth. The reason for the thinking behind that is, why should the gospel writer tell us that he was the father of Alexander and Rufus? Of what significance would that be? Why should he tell us, you know, in one sense, that he was a Cyrenian? We're told that Peter cut off Malchus's ear. We're told his name. Interesting, but no meaning behind it. But we're given a lot of information about a man who we don't read of before and we don't read of after. Why? I believe it's done for a reason. Can we go forward to Acts chapter 13? Acts chapter 13 and verse 1. Now there were in the ecclesia that was at Antioch certain prophets and teachers, and Barnabas, and Simeon that was called Niger, and Lucius of Cyrene, and Manaen, which had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch and Saul. Now other translations put verse 1 this way. Now there were in the ecclesia that was at Antioch certain prophets and teachers, as Barnabas, and Simeon Niger, and Lucius of Cyrene. So Simeon Niger was one person, and Lucius, both of which was of Cyrene. Could that be the one mentioned in Acts chapter 13? And significantly again, the word Niger means black. And some have suggested, now whether that be true, it's where we today get the word nigger from. And again, some have suggested that Simon, the Cyrenian, was black. Irrespective of that, that's just for, you know, something to think about. It seems to indicate that there was a Simon of Cyrene who was in the ecclesia at Antioch. Mark tells us that he was the father of this one Rufus. Now if you go to Romans chapter 16, when Paul is giving us a list of various brethren and sisters, two people specifically are mentioned. Verse 13, salute Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother and mine. Was it the Rufus mentioned by Mark as being the son of Simeon the Cyrenian? And also in verse 21, you've got Timotheus, my workfellow, and Lucius. Was the Lucius there the same one who was with Simon the Cyrenian in Acts 13 and verse 1? The point is, we won't know until the Lord comes. But it does seem significant that perhaps these names have been given to us in that the one who bore the cross and was compelled to bear the cross for a short journey was so impressed with the reaction and the attitude of the Lord that he willingly bore the cross for the rest of his life and became baptized and accepted the teaching of this one whom he had led, as it were, to be crucified.